Welcome to our class tonight. Scott and Scott's handing out a listening guide, and for those of you who have youngsters, they'll be this might be a way for you to be able to think with them through some of what they'll do as well. Although we'll have more information on ours in terms of scripture references and so forth than we'll get to, but maybe you can use it for your study otherwise. I hope all of you are having a great week. Last week we started our study, Rescued, which is a look into, Bill?
Every week's a great week.
All right, every week's a great week. The Rescued, which is a study of the book of 2 Samuel, the book of the kingship of David. And we looked last week at the passages, I don't think you can see, but 2 Samuel 22, verses 17 and 20, in which Samuel looks back at his experience and thinks of the ways God has rescued him from all his enemies, and he gives thanks to God for that. I want for a moment to ask you to contemplate with me the emotion which is loaded up in the idea of rescue. Any episode or event of rescue is bound to carry with it a whole boatload of different kinds of emotions. I was wondering and thinking about this since we met last. Of course, we had the storms that came through our neck of the woods here. Did any of you happen to see the young man up in the Fair Play area? Kenneth is nodding. Did you happen to know them? Okay. Did you guys see the interview with the young man? He was at work in Fair Play when the storm came through and the warnings for it and so forth. And he immediately became concerned because he could tell it was going to be in the area where his home was, and his wife and baby were at home by themselves. So he left work, immediately jumped in the vehicle and headed home as quickly as he could get there. And when he drew near, sure enough, it was obvious the bullseye of that storm had been his home. There's all kinds of damage around. He has to park the truck and make his way as quickly as he can to his house while he is calling out the name of his wife. There's stuff scattered all around, and of course it's later in the day and it's not easy to see and nobody answers. He tries to call, he tries to shout out her name and all of that. Nothing happens, and he grows panicked with it. And after a while he gets a call to let him know that his wife and child are at the hospital and that they are well. Now, what kind of emotion goes with that story? He was not simply telling the story when I saw it. He's not just telling it like dispassionately like a reporter covering an event. He was telling it like someone who was so relieved at what happened. Now, I picture the beginning of 2 Samuel. Tonight, we're going to begin to look back now and work our way through this book and see what he meant when he talked about God rescuing him. And in the first chapter of 2 Samuel, there are a couple of ways I can maybe illustrate the tension which is in the air. A lot of you know that 2 Samuel is originally a part, really the books of the Kings too, a part of one book until the Greek translation of the Old Testament happened in about 230 B.C. and it gets divided. So here in this situation now, when 2 Samuel ends with the death of Saul, David has been off on a goose chase of his own because he tried to go up toward the battle with Saul, and the lords of the Amalekites didn't trust him, and they sent him back home. And when he got back to Ziklag, where he was staying at the time, All of his family, all of his men's families, all their possessions have been raided and carried off by the Amalekites. And David had to go, guess what? Rescue them. When he gets back, within 3 days, a messenger has made the 100-mile journey back to him to tell him what happens to Saul. Now, here's the thing. In First Samuel, the very first victory that Saul gave the Israelites, the very first rescue, the very first delivery that King Saul at that time did for his people was the people of Jabesh-Gilead. Now, at the end of 1 Samuel, after Saul has taken his own life, and after the Amalekites have taken his body and nailed it to the wall somewhere, guess who comes and takes it down? The men of Jabesh-Gilead. So we've gone from delivery to disaster in that way. Now, in 1 Samuel, who is the first, the representative of which people, the first great victory that David wins? I'll give you a hint, he was big. Goliath, a part of which people was Goliath? The Philistines. All right, now, so when we start getting to know David, he's won a great victory over the Philistines. Now, when we end 1 Samuel, where is David living? All right, he's living in a Philistine city. Why? That's the only place he could hide from Saul. So when you see this running in the background, how does the story, how does the stage look when we're ready to watch this first scene? You've gone from him, from Saul's delivering a people to them taking his body down where it's been nailed. And we've gone from a great victory over a giant to having to hide in one of the cities that that giant represented to get away from your own king. It's a sad situation. Here's what we find out now. If you look with me in 2 Samuel chapter 1, this is, I wish that we had someone to carry around a mic boom or something just to hold it where you guys could, some of y'all could read for us. But in order for us to hear, just imagine this, 2 Samuel 1, I'm going to read 1 through 4, and then we're going to read, let me move over here, then we'll read verses 11 and 12. Just imagine the emotion, that's what I like to consider. And after the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking the Amalekites, now remember, why did he have to return from striking the Amalekites? They carried off, they burned his town, carried off his family and all his possessions. It was terror in that way. David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And he came to David. When he came to David, he fell on the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And by the way, why would he be paying homage to David? He's recognizing him as king, if you think about it. "Where do you come from?" He said to him, "I've escaped from the camp of Israel." David said to him, "How'd it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Skip down to 11. "Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them and said, and so did all the men who were with him, and they mourned and they wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel. because they had fallen by the sword. That packs an emotional punch, if you stop and think about it, doesn't it? Bad, bad, bad to hear what's happened to the Lord's people in that way. Now, try to bear that scene in your mind with me for a few minutes, and just remember that this is the very dramatic moment when David is delivered finally from several years. I don't know how many it is, but years of having to run and hide from threats against his life that happened because of other people's wrongdoing, other people's mistakes, not for anything David had done, right? Tell me some of the places where David had to go to hide during this period of time. Caves, several caves, more than one are mentioned here. Other places. Pardon? All right, other nations like the Philistines, various wildernesses. I remember reading the wilderness of Ziph. Doesn't sound too inviting. The wilderness of Moab, the areas that are outside the populated areas around Israel at the time. He's gone to the house of priests. What happened to the priest, by the way, who let him have the showbread to get him to survive? Yes. All right, under a tamarisk. Right. They killed, this is Saul and his cohorts, killed 85 priests to the Lord for just helping David survive. That's how bad this is. It's gone on for years. David has reached all the depths you can go through. And this is the event of rescue. And while it is agonizingly painful to start with here on this first sight, this is really the beginning of the kingship of David, right? So now think about the situation here. Have you ever needed to be rescued from the consequences of mistakes that other people made? I mean, all of us know that we make mistakes as persons, and then we live with the consequences of our mistakes. Have you ever needed to be rescued from the consequences of somebody else's mistake? I'm not going to ask you to name names. So don't. Have you? It could be family, it could be another driver on the road, it could be somebody's mistake who's in a place of power like a boss or an official or someone like that. It could be a neighbor, it could be somebody you don't know, somebody you do know. But all of us are born into a world where we are impacted by the mistakes that other people make, right? Just the way life is. For example, how many of you in here have been affected by the mistakes of Adam and Eve? All right, every single one of us are in the process of being affected by the mistakes of Adam and Eve, if we haven't been already, in some degree. So the thing about that is, what kind of emotions then is it possible for a human person to experience when he knows he is being adversely affected by somebody else's mistakes? Name me an emotion or two that it's possible for us to feel when we are affected by somebody else's mistakes. Anger is one, definitely, isn't it? Frustration and anger. Can you tell me another one? Fear would be one. What next? That idea. Can you tell me another one? Pardon? Sadness. Right, sadness. Somebody lets you down. You experience a certain kind of grief with that. What else? Resentment. Yes. All right, relief from a near miss, what else? Eventually relief, yes. So all of those are examples of emotion. What part do emotions play in our being human persons? All right, in a real way, they at least influence our actions. We can sometimes make choices that we don't really feel like making because we know we should, but they definitely impact. They help us understand ourselves. They help us understand other people. They help us reflect the image of God. For example, does God ever get angry over mistakes that people make? Yes. Does God ever get grieved over the mistakes that people make? Ephesians 4 says the Spirit does that. Does God ever experience joy over things people do? Yes, if we choose to come back to Him. So you can see that. Now, what we're looking at in 2 Samuel 1 is in some way the story of all of those emotions in relation to the rescue which David experiences here. We need, in order to have a footing to make our way the rest of the way through this journey, to be aware of the ways in which David has been up to now impacted by the mistakes of other people. And I've taken my book and tried to make the journey through 1 Samuel the last several days, and if you think I put a lot of stuff on this outline, just remember how much I left out, all right? Think about this with me. First off, all the people of Israel made a mistake that had an impact on David in one way or another throughout his life. And you hear the people themselves say this in 1 Samuel 12 at verse 19. This is after the farewell address of Samuel. And he's reviewed their history with them and showed them the place that they're asking for a king has in this history. And at verse 19, it says, all the people said to Samuel, pray for your servants to the Lord your God that we may not die, for we have added to all our sins this evil to ask for ourselves a king. What's their emotion like in that situation? Do you recognize any fear or regret in what they just said? Also, you see them exercising conscience enough to realize that they've made a mistake. They've done something that wasn't best. Now, just real quickly, may I point out, and you help me with this with your comments, the mistakes that the people of Israel have made. Number one, and the things in red here are actually blanks on your paper if you're following along with us in that way. The first way to recognize kind of the track that we're going down here is that they chose a king like other nations had, rather than the unique relationship that Israel had with God as their king. They have been, what's the word about their government circumstance up to now? Theocracy? They've been a theocracy up to now. And ironically enough, before this passage here in chapter 8, they've just been through the great victory that's involved the ark coming back from the Philistines. You remember what happened when the Philistines captured the ark? And they took it and put it in the house of their God. What happened? All right. Wasn't it Dagon? The god fell on his face. I think he might have broke his head or something. I'm not sure. But a great victory. Philistines, you didn't have to go capture the ark back. They brought it home. They brought it back. Please take this holy thing off of our hands. And then Samuel has led them as a judge and given them victory too. So when you've had one victory and another victory and you have relief, what's the natural thing to do for a human? That'd be natural, but maybe more natural. Oh, we can't stand this. We want a king like everybody else. You know, like the ones had that we just beat, that God just defeated without even an army. That's the kind of king we want. That's kind of what happens. And these two verses here, there is the request that they make. It wasn't just that they ask a king. It's that they ask a king like the nations to fight their battles for them. And God says, they've not rejected you, Samuel, as a judge and prophet. They've rejected me from being king over them. They haven't just rejected a judge or a prophet. They've rejected a God from being their king. Can you think of any ways where similar choices get made in our lives? How do we look for, instead of just having God to rule over us? It may be an expert. It may be the crowd, popular opinion. It may even be exalting civil government to the place of deity. Paul's pointing to self, our own thinking, our own thoughts, definitely. The entertainment field. That there's all kinds of things like that. The second thing that happens is they insisted. Now think about what I'm saying here. See if you see anything wrong. They insisted that God obey their voice rather than seeking to obey His voice. Ordinarily speaking, if you are devoted to God, who would have the say in what would be needed and what would be best in your national experience? It would be God. When David and all the people with him end up in 2 Samuel 1 tearing their clothes and grieving over what's happened, did you notice? It's what happened to all the people of Israel, the people of God. But here's the people of God wanting to tell God what to do. Does that ever... Can you think of any ways that happens or could happen? What if I said it this way? Well, my God would do this or wouldn't do that. Have you ever heard a phrase like, what's that saying? I have a God who'll do what I tell Him to do. What I want Him to do. That's a part of it. Whenever the guiding principle is our preference, then that's kind of what happened here. And I've got the verses. I'm not going to take time at this point to go and read those, but that's the verses. The third thing that happens, and this one I do hope you'll think about carefully. When they ask Samuel for a king, God tells Samuel, go ahead and give them a king, but not till you solemnly warn them what that king will do. And long story short, what did Samuel tell them that king would do? All right, he'd take their possessions, he'd take their children, he'd take their property, he'd have them be a part of his army. Basically, though, he'll marry your daughters, etc. Basically, what Samuel tells them is, you ask for a king like the nations, he'll do like the kings of the nations do. Right? The problem is, God says to His people, if you get a king, then if you and your king do what I command you, I'll bless you. But if you and your king, or your king, don't do what my word says, then you'll both fall. That's the way he says it in chapter 12 here. And I've got this passage. So here's verse 13 through 15 of 1 Samuel 12. Let me get it, if I can get the right verses here. I think I mean 23 through 25. No, let me find. Here we go. 13. Behold, the king whom you've asked, behold, the Lord has set a king over you. This is after Saul is anointed. If you will fear the Lord and serve Him and obey His voice and not rebel against the command of the Lord, and if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it'll be well. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord, and then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. That sounds one way when you just read it like that. But if you read it against the background of chapter 8 and verses 9 and following, then you conclude, well, any man who is appointed king is not going to do this. Therefore, what is our asking for a king going to do to us as a people? We have just guaranteed our own agony, if you think about it. If you think in your mind, those of you who are readers of the Old Testament, of the entire long history then of the kings, isn't that pretty much what happens? How much of the agony of the people comes from the kings having committed the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, or that kind of thing? And so all of this affects David as he goes along, of course, too, in very significant ways. So not only the people, any of those three points we just hit, any of things stand out to you that you want to comment about or that you have a question about? First way, David's life is obviously impacted by all that. More so, Saul's mistakes. Saul made mistakes that had awful implications on the entire big section of David's life that happens from 1 Samuel 16 on to the end of this book and then beyond. In 1 Samuel 26, verse 21, this is Saul. I have sinned. I found three places in this book where Saul says that. Did he ever mean it? How do you know that? All right, he might have admitted that he did it, but he wasn't repenting of it because he went ahead doing the same stuff. All right, I've sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I have acted foolishly. I've made a great mistake. You know what David did? Chapter 27, verse 1. John, what does it say David thought to himself in his heart when Saul told him, I've sinned, your life is precious to me? All right, he says, now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. So that tells you that he knew Saul could not be trusted. So here are the three mistakes, of, I'll summarize them for us this way, that Saul makes that so impacts David. Number one, Saul would not listen to God. This is crucial right here, and I think of this. If he thought something else would be better, in those cases then, he refused to obey God. In other words, let me rephrase it. I will obey God as long as that seems to me to be the best thing to do. What do you think of that brand of obedience? Is it rare? Is Saul the only man who ever practiced it? If you read in 1 Samuel 15, when in the episode of Agag, you remember God tells him, Saul, I want you to go down there, and I want you to conquer the Amalekites, and I want you to devote them and everything they have to destruction because of the evil they've done. And Saul goes down there and wins a great victory. But what? All right. This happened to save alive the king and all the best of the cattle and the sheep and the clothing and the property and the money and all of that. And Samuel gets there and old Saul says, I've kept your commandment. Remember what Saul said? Say it. Say, what's that sound? Those sheep are bleeding off. They're baying awfully loud for sheep who have been killed. And you remember what Saul's... You see something of his character in this, I think. Well, how did he explain this? Like a real man here. How did he explain it? The people brought it, all this stuff, and... And we did it to sacrifice. And if you look at his words, the farther he goes, the more embarrassed for him you get. Here's the way he says it. They have brought them from the Amalekites, the people spared, the best of the sheep and the oxen sacrificed to God, and the rest we have devoted to destruction, like you said, God. Now, notice that fits, if you think about it, with somebody who does what God says as long as that's what he wants to do. And here's one of the great statements in the Old Testament, verse 22 in this book. Chapter 15, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offering and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? The answer is, right. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is iniquity and idolatry, or as iniquity and idolatry. In other words, to have God as your God and to obey Him only as far as you think it makes sense is not different in principle from idolatry, where you choose your God and make Him into what you want Him to be. That's an important principle. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, He's also rejected you from being king. And that episode there was the second of Saul's two great sins. In both cases, God told him, you've been rejected, and God's find for himself a man after his own heart. And so he's going to give the kingdom to a neighbor of yours who's better than you. That's basically what happens. And then, at this point, Saul is overcome with jealousy. He becomes jealous of a man whom the Lord was with. I left out with there. I'm sorry. No, it's there. With whom the Lord was, because he would not, because he would listen to God. Of course, I'm talking about David, right? If you think of this, this makes sense. If you think you're in charge and you get to decide what's best, you're a candidate for someone who seems to be better, for jealousy towards someone who seems to be doing better than you. You think you're in charge and somebody else seems better than you, you can't have that. So what happens? You got to get rid of the rival. And this story with David is, Saul makes up his mind in chapter 15 and verse 28 that this neighbor of his is now going to be his enemy. And you see it really coming to the front in chapter 18, in verses 7 through 9 of chapter 18. The women sang to one another as they celebrated, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his ten thousands. Now, in effect, what that's saying is, Saul, you seem like a mighty ruler, but David is ten times the man you are. How's that go over to a proud guy? Well, look, Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. And he sees what all this means. Verse 9, Saul eyed David from that day on. And then come down to verse 12. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him. And then verse 15, and Saul saw he had great success. He stood in fearful awe of them. And then verse 29, same chapter. When Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Now, up to this point, what has David been to Saul? All right, he's calmed his spirit with the playing of the lyre. That's one thing. He's been a valiant soldier for him when none of Saul's army would act. He's won other victories. He's been completely loyal to Saul. He's been nothing but godly in everything he did. There was no possible way Saul could be critical of David except jealousy. All right. How powerful a problem is jealousy? It's the rage of man, then it said. David? Yes. Cain and Abel. What about the chief priest and others in the day of Jesus? When they saw, when Pilate heard their complaints against Jesus, what did Pilate know about what was moving them? He knew it was for envy. You know, and that's the kind of thing that's happening here. And then Saul sets out to destroy. My time is, y'all bear with me, we'll have to finish quickly. Saul sets out to destroy someone that he, by this time, knew was the Lord's anointed. The last two verses here on your paper show that Saul knew for sure that God was with David. Now, real quickly, got 5 minutes. I've given you an example of how he tried to kill David, the Lord's anointed, and then ultimately killed himself, the Lord's anointed, by falling on his own sword. Now, the point is that David was providentially rescued by God. Not by God simply immediately doing away with all problem and settling all this whole issue and all of that, but by God always making a way for David. I think of this with 1 Corinthians 10, where no temptation has taken you but such as is common to man. For God has with the temptation made a way of escape. So I think David is a case of that. David cooperated with his care, and I'll show you these three things, and then I have an assignment for us. Okay. What is it about David that allowed him to cooperate with God's delivering or God's rescuing of him? Number one, David had a reverence, a godly fear for the Lord's anointed. How can you put out your hand and touch the Lord's anointed? And even with this messenger from the Amalekites in 2 Samuel 1, what happened to him? David killed him. Why? First off, he lied. He didn't kill Saul. Saul took his own life. Second, though, he would have been willing to. David said, "How is it that you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Anointed means this is a person who's holy to the Lord. This is a person God has set apart for His own special service. This is God's man. So, if you look on your paper, the last passage is there. Show you what I'm talking about, especially chapter 26. The two times when David could have killed Saul, the last time he finds him asleep in the camp with his spear stuck in the ground at his head. All of David's men want him to get rid of him. David takes the spear and the water jar and goes up on the hill and hollers across the holler at him. And the reason is he's going to leave Saul up to God's judgment, and he's not going to put out his hand against the Lord's anointed. We are in Christ, the Lord's anointed, 1 John 2. And we too easily are willing to put out our hands against each other's names and each other's persons. Secondly, David had friends who strengthened his hand in God at the critical moments. You got any friends who've ever strengthened your hand in God? How did they do it? Here's your assignment for next time. Everybody in here, find you one of our young people. They can be college age or younger, down to seventh grade, and ask them if anybody has ever strengthened their hand in God, if they've had any friend who strengthened their hands in God, and ask them how they did it. Okay? Everybody find one answer to that question before next week. And then ask yourself, how am I strengthening my friend's hand? I ask you especially to read Abigail's comments to David. I love the picture. Your life is bound up in the bundle with God's. You read that. Please go read that passage. And the third thing is, David had promises that he made to people. Promises to Jonathan, promises to Saul that were commitments witnessed by God. And David was set on keeping his promises. I think for ourselves and for our children, these three principles here are pretty important. How do we communicate to our kids respect for holy things? How do we surround them with friends who will strengthen their hand in God? And how do we teach them to make promises to people and then to keep them? Those are pretty important and deep principles for life. There's more here that you can think about, much more. Yes, Dean. Yeah, that's that's I can't always tell if it's if every age is different in that way, or if we just become more aware of how people really are. I'm not sure, but we can look for a legal way around a yes or a no anymore, almost. Thank you all for thinking along with us here. I'd like for us to have a word of prayer before we go. Paul, I want to ask you, if you don't mind, to stand up and read us. Remember David and Debbie. Also, Russ has a doctor's appointment tomorrow. Please pray for him and Helen. And we do have others of our loved ones who need to be in our prayers. Anybody else specifically that you know of we need to mention in the prayer tonight? Okay. Brad Fox from the church at Ozark. His sister's Debbie. Okay. He's the social services director at Fairhaven as well. So remember Brad's sister. Let's all pray. Thank you all so much for being with us tonight, Paul.